We'll see what's happening in Paris at a conference dedicated to humanitarian aid for Ukraine in the winter.
The donor conference in Paris is expected to raise and help coordinate many millions of dollars of aid, both financial and in kind, to be rushed in coming weeks and months to Ukraine.
Plus, we'll chat with a former Ukrainian president about the future of his country.
Supply the new weapons for Ukrainian armed forces. This is the shortest way to the peace. Remember that. This is my lesson from meeting with Putin.
And we'll find out what's holding up some oil tankers as they go through Istanbul. Today is Tuesday, December 13th. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. As we've been discussing on the program, blackouts and energy shortages are common across Ukraine. Winter has arrived and people are cold. People need help. Well, to that end, donors meet in Paris to do just that. Charles de Ledesma has the story.
French President Emmanuel Macron is hosting an international conference to help Ukraine make it through winter. Dozens of countries and international organizations are throwing their weight behind a fresh push to keep Ukraine powered, fed, warm, and moving in the face of sustained Russian aerial bombardments that have plunged millions into the dark and cold. The donor conference in Paris is expected to raise and help coordinate many millions of dollars of aid, both financial and in kind, to be rushed in coming weeks and months to Ukraine to help its beleaguered civilian population through winter's freezing temperatures and long nights. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And at that meeting in Paris, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky told allies that he urgently needs aid for energy production as Russian forces target civilian infrastructure across the country.
Support with power supplies could cost around 800 million euros. It's a lot, but the price is significantly less than the cost of blackouts for us in Ukraine. So I urge you to end this conference with agreeing on all the decisions for supporting Ukraine with power supplies from the EU countries.
French President Emmanuel Macron said that one of his goals was to develop an online mechanism so Ukraine can put down its urgent needs and donor countries can respond accordingly. Former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko in a few minutes. First, an international price cap on Russian oil has inadvertently caused a logjam of supertankers outside Istanbul. This as Ankara imposes new regulations despite Western pressure. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Dozens of the world's largest supertankers have been stuck outside Istanbul, victims of an escalating spat between Turkey and its Western allies. Since the introduction of the Russian oil price cap, Ankara has been demanding insurance guarantees for all tankers using Istanbul's Bosphorus waterway, a necessity, experts say, given the dangers posed to Turkey's largest city. Mithat Rende is a former Turkish ambassador to Qatar and an energy consultant.
If a tanker carrying crude oil or refined oil and transiting, passing through the Turkish Straits and especially passing through Istanbul, a city of 16 million people, the goods will be insured and then the straits will be insured against oil spills and against collisions because the problem is oil spills and collision.
Under the new sanctions against Moscow, insurers are barred from serving tankers if the Russian oil they carry is sold above the price cap. Western insurers argue Ankara's demand for blanket insurance guarantees could expose them to sanctions if the insured tanker's cargo violates the international price cap. But with Ankara imposing its insurance demands on all tankers, including those not carrying Russian oil, Washington is voicing frustration. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
We've been in touch with Turkey about how the price cap only applies to Russian oil and explained that the cap doesn't necessitate additional checks on ships passing through Turkish waters. Our understanding is that virtually all of the delayed tankers are not carrying oil from Russia and are not affected by the cap.
Russian tankers are complying with Ankara's demand with their domestic insurance, circumventing the international sanctions. Some analysts suggest Ankara could be looking for concessions from its allies. Yurko Shuk is a geopolitical analyst in Istanbul with the Washington-based Middle East Institute.
This government and the Turkish president likes to play, exert its power and make deals on separate issues. If the issue cannot be resolved, then it will become a problem. Now, the more worrisome thing, it looks like we are in an impasse.
Ankara has several ongoing disputes with Washington, including one over the purchase of US fighter jets currently stalled in the US Congress. But in a sign of possible progress, five tankers passed through Istanbul on Monday. Given the winter conditions in the Northern Hemisphere, analysts say the deal cannot come soon enough. Mithat Rende, energy consultant.
Dangerous to let oil tankers heavily loaded with crude oil to be sitting just 20 or 30 kilometers away from here, from the Turkish Strait or from Istanbul.
With more tankers en route to Istanbul, analysts say the pressure is on for a solution to the ongoing impasse. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
You're listening to Flashpoint Ukraine from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish. Joining us now, as she always does at this time, is our reporter in Kyiv, Anna Chernikova. Anna, what's going on today?
Hi, Steve. Today, actually, we have some exciting news from the city of Melitopol, which is in the Zaporizhia region. The city is currently occupied by Russian forces. However, yesterday in the evening, it was a report from some military people that it was a big damage of one of the bridges in Melitopol. So today we have received some more or less confirmations from the Ukrainian military. We cannot verify it independently. But one of the main bridges which Russian forces are currently using for supplies in Melitopol, and just for the understanding, Melitopol in the Zaporizhia region is now the main supply chain for Russian forces after the liberation of the part of Kherson region by Ukrainian forces and after the damage of Crimea bridge. So this bridge was, according again to the information we have, was heavily damaged, and for the moment it is closed.
Thanks, Anna. We'll be interested to see how that plays out in the coming days. Is there more of a military update from the front lines?
Well, today Ukraine experienced another massive air raid siren across the country. It was lasting for a couple of hours, and it was actually quite a big risk of another massive missile attack. However, this was not happening today. The only thing that we know that during this massive air raid siren across the country, a couple of Russian aircrafts were in the air and they departed from the territory of Belarus. And apparently these aircrafts were possibly carrying some Kinjal missiles. However, no attacks were recorded. So it might be that these aircrafts just had, another task, maybe intelligence task, so we don't have exactly information about that. However, the air raid siren went off in a couple of hours, and what happened during this time, we have confirmation of some attacks in the Donetsk region, in the city of Kramatorsk. The residential area was attacked by missiles, and also a couple of settlements in the Dnipropetrovsk region were under artillery shelling by Russian forces, and also heavy battles continued around Bakhmut in the Donetsk region.
Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, thanks for keeping us up to date.
Thank you, Steve.
A look at how propaganda may actually get in the way of peace talks coming up. Now, though, Petro Poroshenko is Volodymyr Zelensky's predecessor as president of Ukraine. He was recently in Washington, where he met with Tatiana Voroshko, the managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service. We'll hear some of their interview in a moment, but first Tatiana gives us some background and context.
Well, Petro Poroshenko is the fifth president of Ukraine. He's also the head of the second largest fraction in the Ukrainian parliament, European Solidarity, and he's a businessman, and also his foundation provides one of the biggest or maybe the largest assistance to the front lines and people who need assistance in newly liberated areas and so far. What interesting about Petro Poroshenko is that he has been in business life and political life of Ukraine for most of its independence. He founded his company Roshen, which produces chocolate, in 1996, and the first he was elected to the parliament in 1998. So there was a lot of time, and he was also as a government official, high level government official, both in Yushchenko, Viktor Yushchenko, pro-European Ukrainian president. Government as a head of National Security Council and as a foreign minister, and he was also in Yanukovych, the more pro-Russian president, as a trade minister. And obviously, he was elected as a president in 2014 with an overwhelming majority, and then he lost the elections to President Zelensky in 2019.
And I find that really interesting. He is a rival of President Zelensky's, yet he seems to be working really closely with him, cooperating with him through this.
Well, the campaign in 2019 was really bruising. There was very harsh criticism on both sides. As Petro Poroshenko told me in an interview, and I also read it in his other interviews, on February 24, he went to President Zelensky and he told him that I'm not in opposition anymore. We're both soldiers. We're both fighting for Ukraine. I wouldn't say there were kind of like cooperation in terms of inside Ukraine. He's mostly working through his foundation, through delivering aid to the front line, to new liberated areas. And so far, what struck me in this interview is not only that they were talking about the same things, but how closely the agenda that he brought to Washington matches the agenda of Kyiv official administration. So they are really speaking in one voice.
One of the things I found so interesting about the interview was that you brought up with him that he met Putin in the past. He worked with him and had meetings with him. And he has a very unique perspective on Vladimir Putin as a man, as well as the Russians as a people, and of course, the Ukrainians as a people. So let's take a listen to your interview. Thank you for your help.
You just came back from the Congress. What is the temperature? Now, we know there's a huge possible package that administration is asking the congressman to approve for Ukraine, almost $48 billion. In your discussion, how is looking?
This is extremely important visit. You know that it was stopped 2 weeks ago when we have a very important meeting in the State Department with the top leadership, with the Pentagon, different institution. And we postponed the meeting because I want to have the meeting in the Congress after midterm election. This is the new reality. And the Ukrainian interests should be protected. And we have a very positive signal about bipartisan support. And our meeting with representative of the Ukrainian caucus, with the senators from both parties, delivering the messages that Ukraine for United States is the top priority, both for the Congress, for the administration, and for most important thing for American people.
You met with Putin many times, so you're one of the few people probably who can have some idea what he's thinking at the moment. Before the invasion started, the talks was about the security guarantee for Russia, the way for the NATO expansion, denazification. Now he's talking about openly about imperialist conquest. So what is he trying to achieve now? How do you see?
First of all, I want to remind you that the war is started not on the 24th of February, but 9 years ago. And when I was elected as president, it was occupied Crimea, occupied Donbass, no money, and no armed forces. That was the condition when we start acting. And within the next 2 months, we create the armed forces, create the process of the armed forces, and we liberate two-thirds of the occupied Donbass. And now the cities which is on the top priority, Mariupol, Severodonetsk, Lysychansk, Rubezhne, Svatovo, they were under Ukrainian control immediately with the attack of Ukrainian troops. And I have no doubt that we return back the control on the troops. We definitely will release everything, including the Crimea, but this is not a final step. The step would be Putin responsibility. The step would be release of Ukrainian land, and the step would be Ukrainian membership in NATO. And my recommendation, which I give to our international partner about Putin, is just two positions. First, don't trust Putin. Please. Don't be happy if Putin signed something that means nothing. And second, learn from Ukrainian experience. Don't be afraid of Putin. Supply the new weapons for Ukrainian armed forces. This is the shortest way to the peace. Remember that. This is my lesson from meeting with Putin.
Some of our audiences say, like in Africa and Latin America, it's hard for them to understand, like, why Russians do this to Ukrainians, what Ukrainians did. Like, do you have answer to that?
Yes. Nobody in the world can understand why Russia doing that. The only reason we can explain, Putin is a maniac. Because we don't have any other explanation. But now when I hear when during the IDU forum in Washington, D.C., with the leaders or with the opposition leaders of African nations, because for us it's extremely important to create the global coalition for supporting Ukraine and global anti-Putin coalition, they now do not need any additional explanation of what's going on, because Putin weaponized energy, and they pay more money for the poor country, pay more money for the energy. They weaponize food, and we have a danger of starvation for the half of the billion of the people throughout the world. And Putin weaponized refugee problem, Putin weaponized everything, and we need to have a scenario how to protect the world from Putin, how to de-Putinize Putin.
It's Putin, it's not Russia. So you see its problem just in one man, in Putin.
No, let's not simplify the question, because unfortunately many Russians support Putin, and because of that has a joint responsibility for the military crimes in Ukraine. And Russia need reloading. Russia need process of de-Putinization. We need to cut Russian influence in the world, to stop Russian influence on the bribed politician, stop Russian influence on the non-governmental organization, stop Russian influence on mass media, who is financed by Russian bloody money. And that was the instrument how we do not allow Putin to use a democratic mechanism to undermine the democratic process in the world, because Ukraine fighting not only for our territory, Ukraine fighting not only for our people, Ukraine fighting for the freedom, democracy, for the whole Western world. And Putin now saying, okay, who is Ukraine? We fighting with NATO, we fighting with the Anglo-Saxons, we fighting with you. And that's why it would be the most effective way to stop Putin. Give money, give weapons, and Ukrainian soldier, do your job. Help us to do your job.
What kind of Ukraine you see coming on the other end after the war? Will it be a changed nation, a changed state?
Ukraine would be different, no doubt. Ukraine would be better. I keep my fingers crossed, and I think despite of the very severe losses we have, people, industry, economy, cities, we will very much value about this price we pay for the future Ukraine.
That was Petro Poroshenko, former president of Ukraine, speaking with my colleague Tatiana Voroshko, managing editor of VOA's Ukrainian service. Monday on the program, we heard from Robert English. He's the director of Central European Studies at the University of Southern California. We spoke about propaganda, why and how it works. But what happens when it works? What happens when a population is so riled up, so emotionally invested in an outcome, that compromise seems impossible? How then can peace be possible?
Yeah, you raise a good point, right? Both sides have set kind of maximalist goals. Both sides have painted the conflict as so stark that there is no compromise, or else they'll be backing down, they'll be losing face. And yet there will eventually be some kind of compromise, so it will be a delicate retreat, a partial losing of face for all concerned, including the United States, including the EU. My suspicion is that, well, the first thing I'd say is, of course, Putin has a less difficult time backing away from his propaganda or settling for less than his original goals because he still controls most of the media and most public opinion in Russia. For Zelensky, it's a lot harder. Right? They have been fighting this war. People are angry. People don't want to settle for anything less. They're much more motivated than the Russian public is. And Zelensky has made so many promises, including, I'm sure this is what you're assuming, that we will liberate Crimea as well as the whole Donbass and the rest. But many military observers say the likelihood is that they won't get away. They won't be able to do that. They will very, very possibly over the next 6 months continue steady advances. But Crimea will be another order of magnitude, and it could be extremely dangerous because it's much better defended. And that's where the Russians could do something insane, like use a weapon of mass destruction, because it matters so much more to them.
Why?
So because of Russian history, because they've been holding it for 8 years, not just 8 months. Right? It goes back to 2014, and it goes back to Catherine the Great. And even when most Russians were very dubious about this conflict with Ukraine, you know, over 80% said Crimea belongs to us. Even Mikhail Gorbachev, right, who recently died, who strongly criticized Putin and was deep, you know, strongly against this war. It broke his heart. But he said back in 2014, yeah, we didn't do it the right way. It shouldn't have been such a blunt annexation, but it does properly belong to Russia. The people there are overwhelmingly Russian. So anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but my point is that that's going to be the sticking point, because Zelensky has promised that we're going to liberate the entire country, including Crimea. And for Russia, they can probably give up most of their gains. They probably will have to, except Crimea. So what I see is that the rest can be settled with a broad Russian retreat, but the Russians will insist on keeping Crimea. That's something they won't negotiate. That's something they will fight, you know. You know, mass mobilization, more production of weapons, just really to the bitter end. And that will be extremely costly for Crimea. And by, if we reach that point, then we're probably in a situation 6 months, 9 months from now, where in fact those protesters in Germany or Italy are no longer a minority, but more and more of public opinion is saying, enough, let's compromise. Let's let Russia keep that damn Crimea. They're willing to give up the rest. That's the deal we have to strike. And at that point, it's really tricky diplomacy for Biden, for Secretary of NATO Stoltenberg, and Ursula von der Leyen, the European leader, to persuade, to nudge, to push Zelensky to make this one big concession to save his country. And probably it'll come down to a promise of massive, colossal aid to rebuild Ukraine to be something bigger, stronger, and better than ever before, and make swallowing that bitter pill of losing Crimea acceptable. It'll have to be a really big sweetener to pull it off. But that's what diplomacy is all about. That's how wars end.
That's Robert English, Director of Central European Studies at the University of Southern California. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Just follow VOA News.
This is the voice of America, Washington, WZTC.
On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karasch.